I'm supposed to give the introduction. You know, I was told to give this really long speech about all this stuff, but I'm not going to do that. My name is Dwight, and I'm from Peace Coalition, and we put this event together with the help of SSC, Black Family Reunion, Students of Color Alliance, and Women's Center. And I know we're a radical group on campus, and I think that what we're trying to do is make connections between militarism and globalization at home and abroad. We're going to have an event on the 16th around the RNC, trying to get people on the same page with kind of organizing that's going on here, so it'd be great to see people out there. I think we might have a sign-up sheet, but if we don't, we'll have one by the end of this event. So, this is Ashanti Alston. He's an amazing individual. Yeah. Let's all give it up for Ashanti. I think he's going to be able to take care of that better than I could. So, Ashanti.
What am I talking about tonight?
Oh, some stuff.
Hi, y'all. Back in them days when I was young, we would start off by saying power to the people, and the audience would respond back by saying all power to the people. So just for old time's sake, and we'll just do it once. All right. And I'm sure I'm probably gonna move from around this thing sometimes too, because I don't stay stationary a lot of times. But anyway, just for old time's sake, please and elder. Power to the people.
Power to the people.
Wow. That's nice. All right, I just turned 50 in February, and it's 30 years beyond what I thought was going to be my end date. I didn't think I was going to make it past 20, but I've been here for 30 years over, so I feel like I must be doing all right. It must be meant for me to hang around because y'all are supposed to be doing something like making that revolution. So somebody said I'm supposed to hang around. Don't disappoint me. Okay? I can get like this now because I'm an elder. So elders are known to be ornery, you know. Sometimes we cuss you out, but you know we love you and all that other stuff. So anyhow, I want to talk about the Black Panther Party. I want to talk about what it meant to me and what I hope it means to you or can mean to you. Because in these days and times, we got to do some work. You know, we got to do some work. There's some scary stuff going on in this world today. All right? And if we don't do something quick, and if young people don't take the lead, I think we might be going down for the last time. And I really do think that. You know, this is just some madness. But it's like my hope always lies with you. And every time that I feel like things look cloudy and we may not make it, you tend to do something. Somewhere, here, anywhere in the world, that's about struggle that says, okay, Ashanti, it's okay. We're going to do it. You know, so like you're my hope. And it's concrete because I know that as long as you're alive and as long as you're doing your thing, in your spirit and in your way, we can organize our lives. We can build movements that can change this world. And like us, you have to do this in your style. Right? And that means like folks like me gotta really understand this hip hop stuff and this crazy way that y'all dress, you know, the baggy clothes and the 1,000 earrings in one ear and in the tongue and in the belly button and sometimes lower and in other places. I'm like, man, I know we was wild, but y'all are wild, you know. But that wildness is things that make revolution. So, right on, you know. They talk about our afros, and they talk about our bell bottoms and them platform shoes we wore. And back then, even that R&B was crazy music that my mother and them, you know, considered. Even though, you know, she really got into it too. So, but it was like every generation do their thing. We do it in our style. So you're gonna do it. You're gonna do it in your style, and that's all right. I was born in 1954. By the time I was 13, I was trying to understand what was going on in the world. And what happened in 1967 when I was 13 was there was rebellions all over the country. Newark, Detroit, New York, all over. Even in my town, Plainfield, New Jersey, which is a small town, you could fit Plainfield maybe into the park here, you know. That's how small it is. But it was very racist, very divided, you know. And so at even a young age, you know, I had them experiences of, like, racism. All the stores were owned by white people. Only stores that we owned was a couple of funeral parlors and the barbershops, you know. That was it. Police was the same everywhere. You know, they didn't give you much respect. They did order you around a lot, and you would witness them every now and then locking somebody up. So that's your perspective of police. But when we would watch television, and television was kind of a, I think it was kind of new, because not every family, most family had a television, but not every family had a color television. And it seemed like when we got ours, we might have been one of the first in the neighborhood to have a color television. But it kept you in front of it all the time. But at this time, you're watching the civil rights movement damn near every day. And when you're watching that, you're watching black people fight back. You're watching white supporters fight with black people fight back. You're watching white folks who were racist, whether they had sheets on or they had blue uniforms on, fight and dog protesters, activists. And for me to see that, you know, was like, this is some vicious shit. I watch the news and protesters are doing a sit down in the street, and here comes the police and fire department with the water hoses, and they are like, it's like they are roaches, and you just want to flush them down into the toilet. Now, for me to see this at 13 years old, I'm like, mm-mm. There's no way in the world I can accept that. And at this time, this is this, you have the two classic figures. You got the Malcolm X, and you got the Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, great man. He was about nonviolence. Malcolm X was saying, you don't have to accept that. Fight back in any means necessary. And we love both of them. But in the environment that I came from, fighting back was a priority. One did not lay down. Even though it took tremendous discipline and even an inner dignity that had to be strong to sit down and let folks do that to you, even to spit in your face. That's not a chump that will sit there, that gets to the point where they can train themselves and say, I'm going to demonstrate, I'm going to do some civil disobedience, and I'm going to allow you to do this to me, and I'm not going to bust your ass, you know. So we understood that and respected it, but we were more towards, we're going to fight. 67 was a rebellion. So when Plainfield had a rebellion, it was different from a lot of other cities. One, there was a gun manufacturing place right outside the city. Somehow folks found out about it, and they visited this place, and they came out with crates of M1s. They brought them back to the community. It's expropriation. It's not a crime, you know. People are gonna, you got to do what you got to do. But anyhow, what was for me to see them run the police out of the community was tremendous. And then to see what they call looting, which was just expropriating and extended democratic shopping, right? Bring them goods back and actually give them out, that had a tremendous impact on me. And I remember this one black car in particular. This one brother had this black shiny car. It looked like it was brand new, but on the top of it, it had Black Power written on it. And he parked it right close to the house where I lived and opened the trunk up, all kind of goods. Folks helped themselves to it. It had a tremendous impact on me. What influenced me was the ability of people to fight back against these folks. You know? They ran the police out. The state troopers came. They was able to run the state troopers out, but it was only when the National Guard came in with the armored cars and them little tank versions and things. Were they able to take over the black community again? The lesson then was what I saw in terms of the repression. When they set up their checkpoints in the area that I lived in, at the intersection, cars was going by. And every white car, white driven car, was allowed to go. Every black driven car was stopped.
and whoever was in that car got a beating, right? And there was one car in particular that it was a black man, black woman, both of them got out, and they beat that black man bad, right? And all of us are outside, and my age group at the time was like 12, 13, 14. My brother was a year older. His crew was like 14, 15, 16. And then my brother Joe was like the 19, 20, 21. We're watching this. And all of a sudden, without anybody even saying anything, it seemed like we was on this slow march towards the intersection where they was beating this brother. About halfway there, my brother and his crew stopped, my oldest brother, and he looked at me. And without saying anything, I know what he's going to say. I can't come, you know. So me and my crew, the youngest, we had to go back. They kept on going, but then they stopped and they kind of huddled together and then they dispersed. And I just kind of think that whatever they had in their mind, they wasn't going to make a direct attack on these National Guards, but they was going to do something. Never knew what they did. I don't know. But the gunfire back and forth went on, and you would hear the reports on the news that the fighting was going on. They can't contain whoever these people are who are shooting at the police. And then only after all the shooting and stuff, only one person got killed, which was a cop deeper into the black community. But after the National Guard took over, they hurt a lot of people. All right. And the only thing that we could do was, like, the next day, me and my crew, we would find our little spot perched over the train track, and then we would see the white-driven cars, and we would help them, and we would let the black-driven cars go. That was our act of liberation, you know. 13 years old, that's what we thought. But it was no different from what you might see 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old Palestinian kids doing, or Irish kids doing, fighting the British. Or those in Bolivia, Argentina, wherever. You know, kids understand their oppression. You know, understand it well. You don't have to be able to, like, break it down with some kind of sophisticated analysis. You understand what's going on, and you understand who your oppressor is. As you go on, you'll learn more, and you'll get better, so forth and so on. I consider that point my entry into the Black Revolution. But what made it, what kind of solidified my decision on that is at the same time I was trying to read Malcolm X's autobiography. And in trying to read that autobiography, I wasn't a reader. In school, I was good. I think I was kind of like an average student. Liked English, but didn't like book reports because you had to read these books and they just didn't interest me. And I hated books that was thick and had small print. Malcolm X's book was thick and it had small print. And I'm like, damn, the cover, though, captured my attention. Here's a picture of Malcolm X. Finger up in the air, that defiant finger, and it said, you know, from hoodlum, dope dealer, pimp, becomes black revolutionary leader, something like that. And I'm like, wow, you know, I want to know more about him. So I would try to read the book. And even though it was in bits and pieces, like every day, though, I'm trying to read it. And I wouldn't, it wasn't even from the beginning to the end. I would go from page 10 to page 200 and something, and then back to 50 something, but it was like, I'm sticking with stuff that kind of hits me in certain ways with certain understandings. And it's like, he's describing certain things that's going on in my very life, in my community, you know, and I'm saying, this makes sense. And even the points where he's talking about what we need to do to band together, it makes sense. And I had just saw this in this rebellion. I saw people doing this, and it made me realize that this is what we got to do if we're going to stop being treated the way these white folks are treating us. And that's how I saw it at that age, these white folks. Later on, I started to read more. H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael, who popularized the term Black Power. And a book came out called Black Power. And H. Rapp Brown's book was called Die, Nigga, Die. Now, when I seen that book, it's like, I gotta get a book that somebody puts out there that says, Die, Nigga, Die. You just cannot leave that book alone. But now, in reading his book, in H. Rapp Brown's book, you get a more personal development of someone else and how he becomes this revolutionary. But from Black Power, you get some kind of idea of how Black Power might manifest itself in your own community. Because it talks about whatever institutions is in your community that are vital to your life, you should control them. You should own and control them. And that made sense to me. So I'm beginning to get an ideological understanding of, like, what we need to do, what kind of framework we need to kind of see things out of to figure out what's the best way to go. This is junior high school. Already in junior high school, we're leading walkouts from the junior high school, so they don't have Black history, and we're demanding Black history. The high schools are doing the same thing, so we all seem to somehow meet down at the city hall together whenever we walk out. And so here's all these young students down there demanding Black history. Eventually, we got it, you know, and it was like, it was obvious that it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't have been out there demonstrating. And we clearly understood what we were doing because everywhere people was fighting back in some way, right? But when they had Black history, when they finally gave us Black history, we had some excellent Black history teachers. And they were teachers that was not only wanted you to know what Black history was, we wanted you to know that you're carrying something, that you have to carry on something. And I joke, I say it joking a lot of times, but I always mean it. When I say to a young person, I'm giving you the torch, don't let it fall, you know, because that's what they would tell us. We are carrying something. Them lessons was put in us at that age because, like, revolution was, like, in the air. Black Power was, like, in the air. And people was picking it up like that. You could not walk down the street with somebody ain't throwing a fist up at you and saying Black Power. Folks is looking at you, white folks, Black folks, whoever, like, whoa, what is that? You riding down the bus and there's a fist stuck out the window, Black Power. Folks on the street, Black Power. We had songs, oh, beep, beep, Ungawa, Black Power, Destroy, White Boy. We had all kind of crazy stuff, right? When I look back on it now, but it was, even the cultural manifestations of Black Power was in the air. People was ready to move. From junior high, we go to high school and find out about the Black Panther Party. At this time, I'm like 16 years old. Me and my closest comrade, his name was David at the time, his name is Jihad now. We're going by a store, and on the rack outside the store, there's all these magazines. And I don't know if it was Newsday, Newsweek, one of them, but it has a picture of Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton. Black beret, black jacket, powder blue shirt, black pants, black boots, and guns. And me and him is like, we respect Martin Luther King. And we've been listening to A-Trap Brown and Stokely Carmichael, but we like this. They got guns. They're serious. So we would go to Jihad's father, to David's father, and his father was just as interested too. So his father would take us to Jersey City, Newark, and New York to the Panther chapters there. And we would talk with them, we would get their literature and stuff like that. They would tell us what it meant to be Panthers and what they're doing. And sometimes they would come to my hometown and they would like show us how to organize people. After a certain while, we had a whole crew of young people that was ready to do a chapter. And we was like from 16, 17, 18, including Jihad's father and this one other brother from the who was in the military. We was basically teenagers, except for them. But we started a chapter. We had opened up an office. We had a free lunch program. We had a free food program. We're on the street corners every night, on the most dangerous street corners in Plainfield, which is actually the area I grew up with before I moved out. But it was like, these was the areas that the Panthers said, organize. Because this is the people who are most down. Those are the people you'll find who are the hustlers, even the dope dealers and the stick-up kids, but also the welfare recipients and the homeless. And those people, the Panthers said, are the ones who will probably be most receptive to a message of revolution. And that was like, for me to talk amongst them was kind of easy because it was actually my old neighborhood, right? But what I found out was that they were, because they were already in a state of rebellion. Every day they were in rebellion against the system. Even if it was selling drugs, the drug dealing was nothing like it is now, right? even if they were stick-up kids, and that meant sometimes they might be sticking up people in the neighborhood, you know. It was their attempt to try to survive when they were denied jobs, you know, or other assistance. And this was the ways that they saw getting out of it. What the Panthers did was say, why don't you turn some of that around and work for the community? And even when the Panthers said, you know, like, if you're not going to stop hustling, can you hustle for the people? You know, sometimes they were receptive to that. So the stick-up kids sometimes, if we needed money to run the food program and we was low, the stick-up kid was like, here, and we might get a roll of money, right, that they were selling drugs, why they were sticking up their own people, why they was abusing women, why they was like burglarizing their own people. When they began understanding like that, they saw that it was a setup all the time, right? And now they were ready to do something. When they went back to the community, it was the same effect as when Malcolm came out of prison and he went back to the streets of Harlem. Those who knew Malcolm when he was a hustler, and you know, hustlers ain't always the nicest people. And one should not, you know, think that Malcolm was a nice hustler, a nice dope dealer, a nice pimp. You know, you don't make it like that. But now he's back here and, you know, Nation Islam, you dress nice, you do a bow tie and everything, you speak politely to people. That had a profound effect on people who knew Malcolm. It had a profound effect when Panthers who were formerly in the streets were now in the community organizing. People, it took a little while though, people wasn't like quite ready to accept him. But when it was consistent, they began to get respect. And those who've seen the movie, how many people seen the movie Panther? No, there's got to be more than that. No. Anyhow, in the movie Panther, for those who remember, if you haven't seen it, it's not a bad movie.
A film screening.
A film screening. That's all right. Dwight?
Sure.
Okay. Anyhow, in the movie, there's a scene where, and it's actually one of the first direct actions of the Black Panthers. In this community, there's an intersection. There's no street light. And because of that, a lot of times, there's a lot of people getting hit by cars going through the intersection, and sometimes they're kids. The community kept asking the city, take care of this, put up a street light. They kept being ignored. Now the Panthers are on the scene. So the Panthers go to the city and say, listen, you either put up a street light or we'll take this corner over, this intersection over, and we'll regulate traffic. Now the police thought they was kidding, right? Who's these people? But now all of a sudden it's starting to happen, right? Here's Panthers in uniform directing traffic. No more people getting hit by cars, right? It forced the city to put up a street light, right? One of the first concrete, direct, local actions that the Panthers did that was directly related to something that the people were suffering. We learned them same things, that when we work in the community that you do the same thing. What's the issues in the community, you know, and you start from there. What happened in the Panther part is with that when these people, those of us who was from the streets, and I was always like really on the edge. I never kind of made it directly into street life or others. It caught me at just the right time. But anyhow, when people saw former hustlers and former homeless and welfare recipients organizing, it gave people a sense of pride that anybody can rise up out of their circumstances and become a positive contribution to their society. Panthers in Plainfield began to grow, just like in other cities. In New York, they had like a chapter in every borough. And I think at one time in Brooklyn, there was two, you know, and that's how popular the Panthers were. And what was scaring the system was not so much that Panthers had guns, it was the programs, especially the free breakfast program. Why? Why was that so dangerous? You are feeding kids before they go to school so that they can learn better. You would think the government would, great job, we're going to give you a medal. They attacked the office even more. They attacked Panthers even more because the idea was revolutionary. The idea that we could take care of ourselves, it was self-determination and action. It was saying that we don't even have to rely on you. We don't even want to rely on you. We will take care of our own. And it was the same thing when Panthers did free clinics. Why shouldn't medicine or medical care be free? That was the whole idea around it. free clothing. Why shouldn't clothing be free? Right? Putting out ideas like that were quite revolutionary. And you're talking about, on the average, a lot of us were functionally illiterate. And the only way that we learned was that we was inspired by the ideas of the Black Panther Party, that we could be these revolutionary agents in history that could make a change. When everybody else said we wasn't shit, we could do it. Because Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and others said, yes, we can. So here I am. I'm here at 16. By 17, me and David, we are Panthers. We have got a crew together, and we have now established a chapter. At a certain point, there was a church in the Black community that they did bingo. And when they did bingo, there was a police on the scene, you know. But one night, police get shot and killed. They took three or four young brothers, and they was like 12, 13 years old, took them down to the station and laid out a bunch of pictures. Surprisingly, me and David's picture, me and Jahad's picture, was amongst them. And for some strange reason, they kept directing the kids to our picture, where it was clear that that's the ones we want you to pick. All right? So, a month later, me and David, me and Jahad, and I'm going to switch that up a lot of times, we're going to court for burglary, because that's part of the way that we funded the free lunch program. But we broke into white folks' houses in the richer neighborhoods. So that's what made it all right for us. We were young. And we wasn't supposed to do it as Panthers either, but, you know, we wild. But anyhow, so one of these burglaries, we get caught. And this is the day that we're going to court for. It's a month after this cop had got killed. As me and my mother walked into the court building, getting ready to push the button to go to the elevators, a swarm of police come down and they snatch me up and they accuse me of the murder of this cop. David comes in maybe half an hour later. Same thing happens to him. So here we are, juveniles, being taken for the murder of a police officer, the first juveniles in New Jersey being charged as adults, and the prosecutor said, if found guilty, we will get the death penalty, because the death penalty was still in effect. So here we are, and it's clear to me and him that the only reason they got us, because we was the most active Panthers in Plainfield, and we were 17 years old, you know. We was always in the streets organizing, always in the high schools organizing, had almost daily encounters with the police organizing. So now it's clear to us why they're doing it, but it might be clear to you, but once they say murder, that's some serious shit. What are you going to do now? My mother freaked out. I mean, they had to, like, just take her and, you know. But my family was able to get a lawyer. David's family was able to get a lawyer. The first lawyer that came who was trying to take my case, I don't know if you know Leonard Wineglass. Anybody familiar with Leonard Wineglass. He was one of the lawyers of the Chicago 8. Are we familiar with the Chicago 8? Okay, I don't see enough heads nodding. Okay, so you know that if you're not nodding your head, you got some work to do, and I want it done. Because I'm 50 years old and I can say that. Now, anyhow, so when Leonard Wineglass comes to the jail, but he comes to just let me know that he has so many cases because he's a famous political lawyer. He says, you know, I can't do it because I have so many cases I would not be able to do it, you know. But it was really just moving for me that someone of his stature would come to try to take. He was willing to take the case, he just couldn't. So I had another lawyer, and this other lawyer was like of a black law firm in New Jersey that was one of the best. There were stories later that I learned of how my family was able to secure this lawyer, you know. And I'm sure that they never finished paying him, you know. But I think the lawyer saw what was happening in the case and just believed in me enough, and they knew that my family was poor, that he was willing to do it. David had a lawyer that was a public defender, but he was a good public defender. Our lawyers was able to show, and we was in the jail for 10 months before the trial started. And the trial lasted 4 months, 2 months pre-trial and 2 months to trial. The prosecutor relied on our literature to convict us. They had raided our houses. Every book we had, they went through page by page. And I had one book called The Art of War. And The Art of War is about guerrilla warfare. I was serious. I wanted to just tear this country up. But I had certain things underlined. And one of them was about ambushing cops. So the prosecutor takes it, blows it up. It's on the easel, whatever that thing is called, right? And he's explaining to the jury, you see what Mr. Austin did? You see what he's thinking. He's willing to kill a cop to show state of mind. Because there was nothing else that they had, right? And then he goes to some other dramatics about how this possibly had happened and what position they must have got in when they shot the cop and all this other stuff. But the only thing that we had going for us that we had an alibi that me and David didn't even think of because it was a month ago. We had nothing to even think about it. One of our best friend's mothers came forth and said, I know where they were at the day that this happened. They was at my house. And I know because I cooked them dinner. And she was one of the women that, you know, the prosecutor's going to try to shake her case and all that stuff. You just couldn't shake her case. If it wasn't for that, we would probably be either sitting in Trenton State Prison today. They had dropped the death penalty during the course of that trial. I think it was 1972. This was 71 when we got arrested. But if they hadn't dropped the death penalty, the prosecutor was clear, we're going to get. But if it wasn't for that, we would be in prison. And I think that's the thing that turned the jury's mind was that we can't be in two places at once. You know, and it's obvious that the only thing the prosecutor got is our release. You know. So after 14 months of doing all that, we got released. I go to North Carolina. David goes to Rochester, New York. I stay in North Carolina for 6 months. I come back. We organize the Black Panther Party in New Jersey again, in Plainfield again. So we're back to the same thing. We're doing programs. We're helping to sell the newspaper, so forth and so on. But at a certain point, the New York chapter of the Black Panther Party in Harlem was under attack, and they was losing members, some to being in prison, others was just, you know, the repression was so intense they were just leaving. So I was back and forth between the Harlem office and the Plainfield office. But at a certain point, there was three Black Liberation Army soldiers who were locked up in the Manhattan House of Detention. And Black Liberation Army is an arm of the Black Panther Party. There's a point in the 10-point platform and program that says the only army that a Panther member is allowed to join is the Black Liberation Army. Not the U.S. Army, not the U.S. Marines, not the U.S. Navy, the Black Liberation Army. And for us, it followed a tradition of people who had fought back against the system, even with arms. Going back to Harriet Tubman and whoever, whatever they had, people fought back. So for us, the Black Liberation Army was the people's army. And it would do whatever had to be done to protect the community. At a certain point, I was approached by a member of the Panther Party who said that they needed a cell that would be a cell of the Black Liberation Army to help get these soldiers out, Black Liberation Army soldiers, out of the Manhattan House of Detention. So I'm 19 years old. Actually, I'm 18. My girlfriend is pregnant. So for me, I'm getting ready to become a daddy. I have to do some thinking. You know, like, God, I want to be there for my child. But I also want this world to be better for my child. And this is my thinking. My thinking is like they are fighting. The Vietnamese just kicked the United States in the ass. The African Liberation Movements are on the move. They're claiming victories over whatever European power was over them. The Puerto Rican Independence Movement is gaining strength. Wounded Knee had happened. Other things was just like revolution is in the air. We can possibly win tomorrow. Not literally tomorrow, but we can win in our lifetime. So I made a decision that I will go underground to help bring the system down so that at least my child can grow up and be free. Because a lot of our thinking was we will be the ones to sacrifice now so that future generations don't have to go through this bullshit we go through. You know? And I say that to you because even like when sometimes we gather now, we fault ourselves for losing. And we look at like what you go through, and it's like, we didn't want this to happen. And this is why we did what we did, in the hope of things would be different. But that was my thinking. So the next week I came back and said, I'm down. And I brought somebody with me. And he was even younger than me. And it's like, we formed the cell. The cell was with us and other people put together, and our mission was to get them out. And we worked on this mission night and day. There was times where we went 2 and 3 days without sleep because we had things to do to prepare to get them out. If you know that Manhattan House of Detention, it's a massive, massive, massive concrete metal building. All right? The court is there, and then, you know, the jail. And you go in, the only way that we could to actually do this was to go in every day, who we are, our names and everything, and sign in and say, we want to visit so-and-so. And they was even a little liberal where they would let us bring food. So we would prepare food, and we used to joke that the prisoners ate better than us, because the folks would fix them up some really nice meals, and we would take them in. I always have big bags of food. And they got used to us coming every day. Except on this one particular day, we didn't have food in the bag. We had an acetylene torch, we had some weapons, and a few other things, handcuffs even. Right. So anyhow, I'm trying to remember. I'm 50 years old, I don't remember everything. Anyhow, and the only reason I tell this story is because the statute of limitations is out in that. And stupid, right? Well, the reason I tell this story is because at the time where they wanted to take us to trial, there were so many Black Liberation Army cases in court that they feared for the security. They didn't want all of us together. So they let the case go on so long that the statute of limitations ran out and they couldn't try us no more. And being that it wasn't like a capital offense, murder doesn't have statute of limitations, there's nothing that they could do. But the other reason I tell it is because I want people to know that we took those kinds of risks. Others might look at it and say, that's some crazy shit. I'll look at it today and say, that's some crazy shit. But sometimes that's what revolution takes. Those who may be daring enough to take risks that they would not normally take in order to bring down the system. We go up into the visiting room, normal. Bag is down, there's other visitors in the visiting room. And I'm smiling because it's so funny. In retrospect. Once we give each other the signal that it's go, we go into action. There's a guard up there. There's two guards on the floor with us. One's downstairs, one upstairs. The one upstairs immediately gets handcuffed and he's put to the side. The other one just kind of normally comes up. And at the time this one comes up, I'm cut. I have the acetylene torch. And I'm cutting and I look up and here's the guard. So we have to stop, get him, because in his surprise, he don't know what to do. So in that, we get him. We take both of them downstairs to the basement, lock them to the toilets where they belong, right? They belong in the toilet because they are filthy people that just oppress people. Okay. Anyhow, we go back up and I start back to cutting again, but I'm not someone who's experienced with acetylene torch, and I wasn't even supposed to be the one to do it. It was just that the person who was supposed to do it could not do it at the time, and I had to give myself a crash course and like, okay. So I'm cutting away and pretty much like this, and I'm cutting all the way around. I get to about right here to go, and the oxygen tank runs out. And if anybody knows about acetylene torch, oxygen tank, no more cutting is happening. All right? But what happens is with them other places, when the metal is so hot, it sometimes drips. And it almost kind of reseals it. And that's what pretty much happened. And even though we had that much ago, we couldn't push it in. One of the members wanted to shoot it, you know, but you can't. They don't even know on the other side what's going on. And it's like, we have our plan down. Those behind there got theirs down. The visitors who are not with us, they're just New York cool. They ain't watching
it like it's a television show. And their prisoner, who they put on the other side, is just as cool as I don't know what. And we know that when that thing comes open, all of them are coming out, not just the ones we came for. You know, and we would have took them. No question about it. But when it was obvious that we couldn't do it, what are you going to do? It was a hurting feeling for me to have to look at those behind this metal wall and tell them, we got to go, you know. It was especially hurting for me because one of the sisters who was with us, who was part of the cell, was married to one of them, you know. And it's like, they got kids, you know, so it was like very special. But that's where we were at. As Panthers, we had an understanding that revolution sometimes, like when Malcolm says, by any means necessary, sometimes it really means that. And just because you will do such extreme things, extremes of others, doesn't mean that you're crazy. It means that you are that dedicated that you will risk your life. Because we could have messed up in there and there's been a little shootout up in there and all of us came out dead. But once we had to leave, we left. Everything was set. We went right out. They never had a clue on the other side what went on. We got in our little thing, drove off, and we was out of the state. And that's how it would have went if we had to cut the hole. All of them would have been out of there. So we're fully underground at this point. The next day, you know, it's all in the newspapers and stuff like that. And of course they know who we are, and we know that they would know who we are because we had to take that risk. But it was also to let people know that we still have to be daring for our freedom. We still have to do sometimes whatever is necessary to fight back. And those people who was behind the wall there, they was people who had already made a lot of sacrifices from Panthers working in the streets to when they went underground. And when you're underground, you are a guerrilla. You are an urban guerrilla. That means that when you're low on money, sometimes you go to them banks, right? We don't call it bank robbery, we call it bank expropriation, right? Bank robbery is a crime. But when you feel that, you know, this system has robbed you for 400 years, you're only getting what's yours, right? And that's how we looked at it, right? And when we went to them dope dealers and we took their money and flushed their drugs down the drain, we put that money to use in somebody's community program, you know, so that that program could go on and be effective. That's what we did. And I don't regret none of that, you know, and it's like if people, and I always think that at some point, because things are so bad today, people will again move to that level again. I just hope people learn from our mistakes, but also understand the dangerousness of that. It's not for everybody, but it is a part as legitimate as anything else of our struggle. Panthers gave us that kind of understanding. Panthers gave us a way to see ourselves as actors, as in a way no one else had. And for us, when every day you bombarded with messages that you ain't nothing but a nigger, you know, you ain't never gonna do anything, and someone comes and say, you ain't that, you know, you are a beautiful human being. Black is beautiful. You are powerful. That's a hell of a thing that you're getting ready to ingest and is getting ready to transform your life. You are really becoming this new human being. And that's what it was for me in the Panther Party. Panther Party had a whole ideology. Panther Party had a whole program, and it was a very direct program. It was a program that served people. Our motto was serve the people. We are servants of the people. The ideology said that we look at this country not only as a racist country, but as a class and a sexist country. Class divided. We wanted folks to understand that we saw it more than just you treated us bad because we were black. You treat us bad also because we're on the bottom and we serve your economic needs. And you dog us more than anybody else. And we got something in common with workers and Native Americans and Puerto Ricans and Japanese who was in the concentration camps
you know, and all these other people, Chicanos, and we need to find ways to band together. Some of the things that made the Panthers different was that we were willing to find allies and work with allies and knew that we had to because we were not in this enclosed world, that our world was very big and connected to a lot of other people. And because we were in the belly of the beast, and we call this Babylon, you know, like, because Babylon had its tentacles in every other country in the world, sucking everybody else dry, we had an obligation to do this monster in, not only for ourselves, but to help other struggles to be able to free themselves. Because if we can tear it up from in here, them tentacles got to loosen up in Zimbabwe, you know, and Vietnam, and all the other places where this country and other European imperialist countries had their hands in. We saw ourselves playing a role that was not just local, that it was very international. A lot of people didn't know that there was a certain point where, because of our relations with the Palestinian movement, that the Palestinian movement would accept Panthers and train them in guerrilla warfare. There were some Panthers who went to Palestine and was trained by the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization. Found ourselves in the company, I wasn't one of them, found ourselves in the company of other guerrilla fighters from around the world who was trying to find other effective ways of adding on to their resistance movements, their liberation movements. I think one of the things that made us such a target was not only the practical programs that we had that was putting out this idea that our liberation had to do with our self-determination, our ability to be creatively involved with providing for ourselves and defending ourselves, but that we were connecting up with others. And it was scaring them. It's the same thing when they saw that it looked like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King was going to hook up at some point. It looked like Martin Luther King was getting ready to hook up with the workers and start to speak out against the Vietnam War. These connections, you know, these people are very afraid of connections that we make, you know. And when that happens, then they got to start taking us even more seriously. So what happens when you do that is that they come after you. When Fred Hampton was making connections with the street organizations called gangs, they knew that it was time to get rid of Fred Hampton. All right, so here's their agent already inside the Black Panther Party in Chicago, who then placed himself in security, that at some point when the local Chicago police and the FBI are ready to kill Fred, this agent puts a drug in Fred Hampton's drink, so that when they're getting ready to attack, they know he's going to be in bed sleeping, ain't going to be able to get up, and they know exactly where his bed is. And when the attack happened, they went directly to his bed, shot and killed him. But what they did to Fred is what they did with leaders and activists everywhere. You know, it just didn't happen here. And I think only reason that the Panthers had such an immediate, or caught the system off guard in the beginning, was that they never expected it. But once they calmed down, they said, wait a minute, we got to deal with them the same way we deal with revolutionary movements all over the world. Let's infiltrate, let's assassinate, let's dry them up financially, let's arrest them every day. You know, let's just dry up their funds. Let's terrorize their communities. Let's make it difficult for people in the community to even go up to them. And a lot of that happened. And at a certain point, our support started to dwindle. But they was also able to play on some of the other contradictions going on in the Panther Party between egos, differences of opinions or approaches to revolution. So when they saw that there was differences between Elders Cleaver and Huey Newton, they played on it. One day, Huey P. Newton gets a letter that's purportedly from Eldridge saying, yo, I don't understand what you're doing, I'm going to kill you. Huey reads the letter, seems like it's from Eldridge. There's already some tension. Probably a legitimate letter. He sends word to Eldridge, I'm going to kill you. The FBI continues to play it and to set up the circumstances where they actually have a falling out. And when that falling out happened, and it happened to happen on national television, with a phone conversation with Elvis from Africa, Huey from California somewhere, and they got to arguing right on the phone. It was the first official break and split in the Black Panther Party. Right? But neither one of them knew who was engineering it from behind. It came out later. And when they was able to see their files years later, they saw the setup. And then others of us saw the setups because it was even happening in local ways. When David got his Freedom of Information Act when we were both in prison, he saw that, we both saw that, it was some members, it was one member in our Plainfield chapter who was an agent. We young teenagers. Was we that effective that you felt you needed to put an agent, you know, in our ranks? So agents did the work of stirring up division, right? And they would play on whatever they could. And if egos was a thing, or a person's sexuality was the thing, or somebody was fucking around with somebody else's woman, man, or whatever, anything that they could use to bring in that kind of division and tension, they would use. All right? And a lot of times we fell prey to it. But it would always make me think in retrospect was, why was it that important? If we were just trying to make things better for our people, why must you go to this left to destroy us? You know, so, 74, after we left from the tombs, the Manhattan House of Detention, we're fully underground, but at another point, when we're low on money, we pass through New Haven, Connecticut, and we say, well, I think we got to stop at this bank and collect some money. And this particular day, though, that we did this, and it was planned, but I know that it wasn't planned well, in retrospect, because we was caught. But we went into this bank, and at the moment that we were coming out of the bank, police car pulls right up in front of the bank. Now, when that happens, you know in your mind that you cannot get caught. So the first car that pulled up got shot up bad, and the police in it got shot up bad. So here we are, we're in our getaway car, and we off. But at the time, there was other cars already on the way, so there's a high-speed shootout in the streets of New Haven. And at a certain point, we had to get out of our car and split up and run. And me and one of my comrades, his name is Tyreek, we ran up into a house. And police, and like even the time we ran up, the shooting is going back and forth. So we had to break the back window to dive into the house and to get away from the gunshots. They come into the house, they break the door down. In the house was an African. We went into an African's house. Didn't know that we was in the Black community in New Haven. And we looked at him and we was like, he has to go with us. Because when they see him and see us, they gonna think he's one of us. So we had to take him upstairs to the top floor. And we put him in a room and we told him like, listen, this is who we are. This is what's going on. It's safer for you to be here. So they're in the house. They're shooting from upstairs. We're shooting from downstairs. Sometimes there's lulls in the shooting. It's so funny the things that go through your mind when all this stuff is going on. He had a bookcase. I love books. He has a bookcase, and I'm checking out his book. I'm checking out his book. He's got Eldridge Cleaver in his bookcase. I know if they come in and see his bookshelf, he's going with us. But luckily it didn't happen. But so I'm doing all that, and then, you know, we're back to shooting and all this other stuff. But But my mind was there. My mind was like, Ashanti, this is war. At one of the lulls, we heard them on their police radio say that one of the other members was just caught and shot. But they didn't say what condition he was in. So at the time that this happened, there was a lot of things happening in the United States. There was the Patty Hearst stuff and all other kind of things. You always hear about these hostage situations. Then the hostage negotiators come. So me and Tyreek, we're not even thinking on that. But the police downstairs want to know, all right, what are your demands? We ain't thinking about no demand. So we look at each other and say, okay, listen, let's tell them something. So we make up something, say, oh, we want a helicopter, we're going to Nigeria.
and it's so funny that death is in the air. And so after that goes on for a while, what we ask them when we hear the report, we say, well, listen. No, but even before that happens, Tyreek looks at me. Tyreek is older. Tyreek is a Vietnam veteran. I'm the youngest in the crew. And he asked me, what do you want to do? When he asked me that, I have to look at him. But what he's asking me first is, whatever decision I make, he's down with. And so I'm thinking like, well, you know, I'm tired. And one of the thoughts was, let's go out in a blaze. I don't know if I got one picture. This is Jonathan Jackson. Who knows about Jonathan Jackson? This had already happened. Jonathan Jackson was George Jackson's brother. He was 17 years old, right? Jonathan wanted his brother out. And at this one particular time, he went to the courtroom. There was three black men on trial. It wasn't his brother, but there was three black men who was part of his brother's organization in the prison. They were prisoners. The mission was to get them out. And as that guerrilla army built up, they would go get George out later. But when they went to the courtroom for this one, they took the judge hostage, they took the prosecutor hostage, and a whole bunch of people and got into this van, right? And George was 17 years old. When they got into the van, the police had, at the time, can't got there before they could get out of the parking lot, and didn't even want to negotiate, wasn't doing none of that. They immediately shot up the van with the hostages and everybody in it. Killed up everybody except for one person. It was Rochelle McGee, who's still in prison. He's been in prison for like over 40 years. But Jonathan was that serious about getting his brother out. Jonathan was like, he never understood why they took his brother from him. And then when he found out that his brother had became this Malcolm X in prison and that there was this struggle going on, he wanted to be a part of that struggle. And he had already been developing his own ideas and his own initiative. This is around the same time that he had a close relationship with Angela Davis. And Angela Davis was like a well-known radical spokesperson. He had got a gun from Angela without Angela even knowing. And he hooked up with some other people who had weapons and was part of this thing. What happened, though, on the day that this was supposed to go down, he was supposed to have a crew of people with him. All right? Grown people who had made a commitment that they were going to be a part of this operation. For some reason, they decided they wasn't going to do it. Jonathan said, I'll do it by myself. So he went in this courtroom with weapons by himself. And at the time that he pulled these weapons out, you know, he announced himself. He said, gentlemen, it's over. The guerrilla is here. He gave guns to the other prisoners. They took hostages, and I think you might see one. This one here is the judge. They have taped the shotgun to the judge's neck, right? This is how serious they are. When this happened, even though they got killed, we was all inspired. Because Jonathan was 17 years old, willing to give his life for his brother. All right? Ours was after this. So here I am, me and Tyreek. And I'm like, I'll go out like George. And Tyreek is a soldier. I mean, he's really a soldier. He was in Vietnam. He's got stories about Vietnam that will blow your mind, because you'll find out that the fighting was not so much with the Vietnamese, but with black and white soldiers. You know, with the racism of white soldiers. And a lot of times they even ended up shooting and killing each other. But anyhow, my first thought was, let's go out. The second thought was, well, you know, we can surrender. And then at some other point, we can escape. All right. But the first thing, and I went with the second decision. But it took me a while. And it's like one of them when your whole life is flashing, you know. But then I said, okay, that's what we'll do. And he said, that's what you want to do? That's what we do. But what condition we made with the police and them outside is we want to talk to that person you said you just caught and shot. And when we know he's all right, then we'll come down. And, of course, their condition was, when we come down, you come down butt naked, you leave your guns up there. All right?
So after they put made the phone available, there was already a phone up there, and we talked to him. He said that he had got shot in the leg, but he was okay. And then with that, we communicated with them, okay, we're coming down. Probably the only thing that saved us from getting shot to death was that it was in the black community of New Haven. There was 250 police, state troopers, FBI just waiting. But there was also a black community. All came out of their houses because of all this stuff, and they were watching. So they couldn't just shoot us down butt naked with no pretense. But if that community wasn't there, I'm sure to this day we would have been shot. We've been shot down. What scared them was they had three black men, or two black men in this house, who was willing to shoot back at them, you know? And that scared them to death. Scared them to death because it never happened in New Haven before. And then they found out later our political background, and it made sense to them. But just the fact that we would fire back, that we were that determined, you know, scared them. During the trial, we took a very political thing. We said that, listen, you have no right to try us. We are prisoners of war. We refuse to participate. What our lawyers did, they had a legal strategy, but that was our strategy. So whenever we had to get up and speak, we talked about the history of this country. We talked about what it did to us, what you do to Native Americans, what you do to everybody else. You know, so a lot of times it was confrontation in the courtroom. Sometimes it got physical. Sometimes it got thrown out of the courtroom. But we knew we wasn't going to get found guilty. We wasn't looking to get, get acquitted. You know, we went in as guerrillas. Our lawyers had a legal strategy, and that was fine. But from the moment that we was locked up, we was always looking for ways to get out. So we didn't get out. There were some attempts to get out, but it didn't happen. And there was a lot of physical stuff behind it. So we got found guilty. So we ended up getting like 45 years in prison. Now, out of that time, you know, feds do time, the state's time, you don't actually do the 45 years. You're going to do some time, you know. So because the bank is federal, we had got federal time. Because two cops were shot, we got 10 to 20. So it ended up being like 5 to 25 for the bank, 10 to 20 for the police getting shot. And they tried to do the kidnapping of the African who was in the house, but they couldn't get him to say that we kidnapped him. He actually told them that they was protecting us, you know, protecting him. So they sent us to prison. I was 20 years old. All of my 30s was in prison. I got out when I was 31. Tyreek, I did a little over 12 years total, though. Tyreek did 17 years, while they did 14. I think the only reason I was the first out was because I was the youngest. And they go into that thing, well, you know, you young, you real young, you was probably influenced by the rest, you know. So, because I didn't understand, anytime I made parole, I didn't understand it because I was in segregation all the time. You know, if the police cussed at me, I cussed at him. If we was trying to get out, sometimes it didn't work, then I know I'm going to stay. And all kind of stuff, but I think that the reason they wanted me out of the federal system because there was too many revolutionaries in there at the time. And they figured, well, you're going to Connecticut to do 10 to 20. You ain't getting out no time soon. So I got out. Then in Connecticut, you know, I got out at the first parole too, but I just did my time different. But even in the prison, our whole thing was you continue organizing. Now that prison becomes your battleground. You organize. You organize them who we call the lumpen. Those are your hustlers. Those are your pimps. Those are your stick-up kids. Those are even your rapists and your others. You organize amongst them. And that's what we would do. And at that time, this prison movement was still strong. You know, it was still going. So folks would come out of that prison and join up with revolutionary organizations. But that was coming to an end, right? Because this is now like the 80s. The whole population was changing because the whole scene on the streets was changing. Them drugs that we fought in the 60s and 70s, they flooded them communities with drugs. They put a whole drug economy in place to make sure it was going to circulate. They made media popularize that whole culture, the materialism, everything, the flashy clothes, all the, you know, outward stuff that you got it. And our young people was buying into it. when they come into the prison, we see a different kind of person is coming into the prison, not that receptive to our ideas like they used to be, you know. So even in the prison, they was making, like, things more available. We started getting transistor radios. We started getting televisions, you know. And at a certain point when I was there, individual television was brought in every cell. And it was all pacification. It was all ways to get people from getting political education or becoming aware about certain things. And it made our efforts very difficult. So when I got out in 86, I would ask young people, what do you know about the Panthers? And I never remember that this one brother said, is that some martial arts group? I'm like, man. 11, 12 years passed, and a generation did not even know. How effective is that? You know, one, you know your enemies is not going to teach it. But on the other side, the horror, the terror that our parents and families had experienced, they were not going to subject those others to that kind of information because they don't want them to get killed. They don't want them to go to prison. It wasn't like you're dealing with the Palestinians and the Irish. They're growing up learning about what past generations did, what past fighters did. Ours, there was a break, right? So, and it wasn't until like the movie Panther and others came out that people began to find out about our struggles, even about the anti-war movement, because a lot of people didn't even know. The ability to shut off your sources of history like that, so that it can't be used to inspire you to struggle. I think all of that has been maybe in the last 10, 15 years that we've been able to get more information and more information out like that. So when I'm able to speak like this, the importance of it is that I get a chance not so much to tell my story, but to tell stories of resistance, to tell stories about how we fought back, to tell stories about how we confronted those problems at the time so that you might also find some inspiration to do the same. Conditions today, in my opinion, are so much worse than when I was that young person coming up, right? Sometimes it blows my mind that certain levels of struggle is not there. I'm like, well, are they waiting for us to do this again? Me and my crew, and I'm the baby at 50 of my crew, right? But I got arthritis. I joke, I say, I can't jump that counter anymore. And when we got plexiglass, I will run right into the plexiglass, right? But even with the Republican convention, the last one in Philly, I mean, I was a part of that shutdown thing, right? But they would make fun of me because I want to be a part of the flying squads. I want to, like, block one of them streets. I want to throw something, a brick or something, in somebody's window or something. But I just couldn't do it because I got arthritis now. So they stuck me off in, like, one of the little makeshift medical clinics, you know. And I played a role, and I had to accept my role. Folks come in, pepper sprayed and stuff. I got my stuff ready to give them, put it on so that you can help get that sting out of there and all like that. But even my crew, like, we're old. And sometimes when we see things going on today, like with the cop killing our kids and stuff in the community, and there's no response, it blows our mind, but it hurts, too. Because the Black Liberation Army at a certain time responded to cops doing that in our community. And when the cops started getting ambushed, the number of cops shooting our kids and people in the Black community went down. They were scared. Because they didn't know where this guerrilla was going to come from, right? And so they're going to arm up, right? They're going to get all the sophisticated weapons, but they're not coming out their cars, right? Because they don't know. And what started happening also, that others started to relate to the gun as a weapon of self-defense, right? But people would look at us and say, oh, you was premature, you was this and that. But if you are not experiencing that kind of oppression, you don't have a clue. And sometimes it just means that you got to kind of check your position relative to others who are experiencing this vicious oppression, a boot that is like deep in your neck every day, and that you have every right to get that boot off, cut that boot off if you got to, cut the leg off, cut everything off. Deal with somebody who wants to talk about it rationally later. You want that oppression off of you. What's going on in the black community today particularly is terrible. When we talk about the prison industrial complex just snatching our people up, throwing them in prison so that the corporations can now have a new source of slave labor, you know, and they get a chance to take certain areas and put condos up and malls up. When we become just pawns, and I've always been pawns, we've always been pawns, but, you know, it's like Harlem, you know, like certain areas they want, they got all kind of ways that they get this area clear of people. Politicians are in on it, judges are in on it, your own landlords and everybody's in on it. Landlords are going to make money, right? And why you want to keep just getting these few dollars from these poor people, and you can put a condo up, or you can do a mall. Right? Get rid of them. New York State prisons, 80% of them prisons come from 8 specific areas in New York City. Right? And they know that. Right? Those areas are also areas that are just gentrified. You know? That rich white folks have decided, hey, we want to build something here. Y'all get rid of them. The message goes to the politicians, get rid of them. Politicians give the message to the police, get rid of them. Right? Everything is set up. The drugs are there, all the things, you got new laws, and now you can just spit on the street and they might arrest you. They can take a squeegee person and just rub that person's life out. And because you frame this person as a squeegee, as a non-existent person, no importance, it's okay. So this is what's happening to folks in black, Latino, poor communities. We have to begin to respond to that. And I'm not saying that the response has to just be directly to guns. We have to organize, but we have to also be willing to use whatever will work. A variety of methods if necessary. We have to build alliances. We have to build the kinds of communities that can even sustain us fighting back. That keeps our self-esteem up. That helps us to heal when we hurt. You know, all these things become important. Because if we don't, we are going down fast. If we go down and we're the bottom layer of society, then it's only a matter of time that the middle class and others come down too. So it really is in everyone's interest to find out what can you do to bring Babylon down. Bring it down. Stop it any way that you can. You know, because our very lives matter now. And when we talk about bringing children into the world, then you're also saying, well, the way it is now, my children's chances in the world are not going to be that great, because mine aren't that great. Don't matter who they put in as president, forget my opinion, forget Bush, right? It's a system much bigger than a knucklehead, right? Much bigger than him. Giuliani, much bigger than Giuliani. It doesn't matter who becomes mayor. The system, it's a system. What can we do to stop the system? Anything else is a diversion. And sometimes the diversion, when we get caught up into it, is costly. More costly for those on the bottom than those in the middle. So we need to think about that. Okay. I know I've talked a long time.